Okay. Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY2 resident. This is the 128th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I will be continuing my rapid review series for the USMLE Step 1 exam. And my focus will be on internal medicine, as that constitutes the bulk of the exam. But before I jump into the topic, I would just want to say a few words about the USMLE Step 2 CK. I've gotten a lot of emails recently about this, and I've seen a lot of people comment on Reddit about how tough the new USMLE Step 2 CK exams are. So there are certain things I would say to that. The first thing I would say is, if you're in the process of preparing for your Step 2 CK exam, right now, a smart play is to strongly consider taking the new practice exams that have been released. So the new MBME 5s and 6s for the different disciplines, right? So like there is internal medicine, there is psych, there is neuro, there is peds, there is surgery, there is OB-GYN, right? I would strongly encourage taking those new exams. They are very close and very representative to what I suspect the MBME will throw on Step 2 CK. That's one. Second thing I will say is, I understand where you're coming from, saying the new exam is hard, right? The thing is, and again, like I remember back in the day, right? This was way back when I took Step 2 CK. I remember that that exam was tough, right? It's not, basically, if anyone tells you the USMLEs are easy, right? They're probably lying to you, right? So I understand where you're coming from. The USMLEs are difficult. But here's one thing I would want you to keep at the back of your mind, right? You really need to understand that a lot of the difficulty, right? So the first thing is assuming that you have a good knowledge base, right? Again, I'm not saying this as a robot or anything like that, right? Again, at the end of the day, you do have to buckle down, put in work, and study, right? But one thing you need to realize that the thing is, it's not like, yeah, we are having a few additions to knowledge every now and then, and the MBME test this new concept and that new concept. But the one central thing I would really want you to realize is that the USMLEs, in general, they tend to test the same array of things, just in general. Again, I'm not saying this as like, oh, for sure, but just in general, right? It's not like the MBME suddenly decided, starting in the month of June, July, to just completely change the exams that they throw out, right? Like to like completely source out new pulmonary knowledge, new cardiovascular knowledge, new renal knowledge, and all that stuff, and then test it on the exam. No, right? The only thing is the question styling may have changed quite a bit, right? So I suspect, because again, I see this from the standpoint of, yes, obviously, there's no way I'm eligible to take the current USMLE Step 2 CKs. I've taken that exam long ago, right? But I have had a chance to, you know, review a lot of the new MBMEs with the students that I tutor. And I can tell you that those questions are, they kind of have a different flavor to them. So the thing I will say is, when you're reviewing your MBME exams, don't just pay attention to the concepts that are being tested. Pay attention to the principles behind how the MBMEs test questions, right? So this is something I tell the students that I tutor every time, right? It's not necessarily about the difficulty of the question. Again, assuming your knowledge base is good. And again, there are good resources out there that you can use to build up your knowledge base. Assuming your knowledge base is good, it is really not the difficulty of the MBME questions that ends up mattering the most. The thing that ends up mattering is the way you approach the questions, right? So the thing is, at the end of the day, right, there are principles that you sort of kind of need to follow. And these are things you can abstract as you if you review your MBME exams thoroughly. There are just certain patterns that the MBME tends to follow in the way they word questions, in the way they demand answers, in the way they write answers that are right, answers that are wrong. So this is something that, in my experience, this is something that people don't devote as much time to, question analysis. So that's one thing I would really want you to keep at the back of your mind. I mean, like literally, I tell my students, like, guys, it's not necessarily the difficulty of the exam that matters at the end of the day. It's like, just ask yourself, are there certain common rules, that you should just follow in general as you're answering MBME questions that would help you get this question right under whatever circumstance. And the thing is, just in my tutoring experience, if you look at the old MBME questions, right? So the MBME ones and twos that are no longer being sold and the current ones, the fives and sixes, yes, the question difficulty may have changed, the question flavor may have changed, the question styling may have changed, but for the most part, those MBME questions still obey certain core principles. Like they are just certain, and I'm not necessarily saying like, oh, core principle in terms of knowledge they test. It's just core principle in terms of how they test and how you should approach those questions. So I will encourage you, spend good time, do those new MBMEs, review them thoroughly, right? And as you're taking those exams, try to ask yourself, what are some key principles that the MBME details that, like, because again, this is something that comes with experience, with practice, but are there some key principles you can abstract that the MBME seems to be following this particular pattern in the way they word questions? If you can do that, that can make a very significant impact on how you do question-wise. So that is just the sidebar I sort of wanted to talk about. But again, the big thing is, if you, especially if you disregard the second part of what I said, try to take the new MBMEs, the fives and sixes. I do think that they are very high yield and they are very good questions that are somewhat representative of how the exam may feel. Okay, so let's jump right into the content, right? So what if you get a question about like 70-year-old female, you know, she comes to a PCP, she says, I've been having like really bad shoulder pain, you know, for like the past week. And she tells you that, you know, over her like left shin, right upper extremity, she's been having all this pain. And you check the shoulder. So you check the shoulder that she's having pain with and you see like a step off or something, right? And then they tell you that, you know, her vital signs are all normal. You get some labs, you notice that her white count is 8,500, so that's normal, right? Her hematocrit is 28%, that's low, right? And then they give you platelets, 192,000, nothing major there. Sodium is 138, potassium is 3.9, chloride is like 100, calcium is like 12.7, so that's somewhat elevated, right? And her phosphorus is 2.6, BUN is like, let me make up some number, like 40, and her creatinine is 3, right? So that's quite elevated. So they tell you every other lab is unremarkable. Last pap smear was like, I don't know, like 2 years ago. And again, they tell you that she has no history of an abnormal pap smear. And, you know, she follows her yearly screenings, preventive guidance. And then they ask, what's the next best step in management in this question? So what would your next step in management be for this person? The first thing I would encourage you to ask yourself is, what do you think this person has? So look at the things I highlighted. This person has bone pain. Her creatinine is elevated. She has a low hematocrit. And she has high calcium. What am I going after there? I'm going after multiple myeloma, right? Multiple myeloma, right? So obviously, you would want to perform your SPEP and your UPEP, right? And say, for example, if your friends or the MBME wanted to mess with your head, right? They would potentially give you an answer choice that says, oh, what is the, you want to do like a dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, right? So like a DEXA scan. Or they may give you an answer choice that involves giving a bisphosphonate, right? Or they may say, oh, you know what, go ahead and transfuse like packed red blood cells, right? Or they may say, you know what, go ahead and give broad spectrum antibiotics, right? So let me sort of focus on this kind of question and how you may approach it, right? So, because all these other answer choices like DEXA scan, those are things that the MBME, right? Just again, just based on, again, my experience with tutoring and taking MBME exams, like those are potential answers that your friends at the MBME want to throw on a question. So think about it. First things first, this woman's hematocrit is 28%. So that means her hemoglobin is a little above 9. Remember, your hematocrit divided by 3 is roughly your hemoglobin. So this woman's hemoglobin is not less than 7, so it makes no sense to transfuse. With regards to the DEXA scan option, right? So the thing is, you do a DEXA scan if you suspect the person has osteoporosis. But if you notice, most of the question, yeah, even if there is a part of the question that says this person has a palpable step off when you palpate the left shoulder and all that, making you think of a fracture, you don't want to just use that as your only thing you're going off of to say, oh, you know, this is the right answer to the question, right? If you notice, most of the question seems to be pointing about these disparate things. And of all of them, the thing that seems to match with most of the question, right, is multiple myeloma, right? So a DEXA scan will not be appropriate. That's a very good trick answer that the NBME could slot in on an exam, right? And then they may say like resegronate therapy, right? Resegronate is, again, for people that have osteoporosis. You've not confirmed that the person has osteoporosis, right? So again, at the end of the day, you shouldn't just jump straight to therapy. And again, if you get led astray that this question, so I imagine some people listening to this podcast probably got led astray that, oh, palpable step off, old person, blah, 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 right? Maybe osteoporosis. But again, if you listened to the rest of the question, right? Between osteoporosis and multiple myeloma, if you listen to all the question I gave you, which one seems to have the most backup for it? It's multiple myeloma, right? So again, that's kind of like a way you want to think when you're approaching NBME questions. So this person, right, obviously has multiple myeloma. Remember, in multiple myeloma, right, you have like the classic crab symptoms, right? So like hypercalcemia, right? Because those plasma cells secrete interleukin-1. And another name for interleukin-1 is osteoclast activating factor. So that can cause hypercalcemia, right? They will have like renal insufficiency because remember those light chains, right, can deposit and screw up the person's kidneys. They can have an anemia because again, those cells are just proliferating and taking over the bone marrow. So they will have inefficient hematopoiesis. And then they typically have bone pain, right, from like pathologic fractures. And remember that multiple myeloma is an example of something that causes like lytic lesions, right? What are the other cancers that may cause lytic lesions on an exam? It may be things like renal cell carcinoma, lung cancer, thyroid cancer, right? And breast cancer can also cause lytic lesions, but it can also cause blastic lesions at the same time. And the way I remember what cancers secrete what, like lytic, I remember the word litter. Right. So like litter, like a cat litter. Right. So the L, right, tells you lung cancer. The T tells you thyroid cancer. The R at the end tells you renal cell carcinoma. Right. And then you just kind of have to remember that multiple myeloma causes the lytic lesions. And remember, in multiple myeloma, right, they may have like a Rouleau antibodies on the, Rouleau formation of their red blood cells when you do a peripheral smear. So that's kind of how you ought to know. Right. And then remember, again, you do a bone marrow biopsy to make the diagnosis. I mean, to screen, you do your SPEP and your UPEP. You'll find a monoclonal spike, right? And then the next thing you want to do afterwards is to, you know, get a bone marrow biopsy. You'll find that they have more than 10% plasma cells, and that helps you establish the diagnosis. Okay, so now let me talk about some pathognomonic findings in diseases, and then you tell me, I'll give you like a vignette, and you tell me what you think is going on here, right? So you tell me like a diagnosis or something, right? So let's assume you have like a 65-year-old guy, right? Tells you that he has like, they tell you in the question like, or, I mean, they won't tell you he has pancytopenia. That's too easy, right? What your friends at the NBME will do is they will show you a CBC. You'll see that the person's platelet count is like 50,000. Their white count is like 2,000. Their hemoglobin is like 8. So that tells you that they are pancytopenic. Everything is low. And then they tell you that a peripheral smear reveals like teardrop-shaped red blood cells, right? So teardrop-shaped red blood cells, or they literally show you like a slide and you see like a red blood cell shaped like a teardrop. I believe those are known as dacrocytes. I will encourage you to look up a picture. What kind of hematologic problem does this person have? Well, I hope you're telling me about primary myelofibrosis, okay? That's a high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about like, you know, like an 80-something-year-old female, you know, she has a 6-month history, recurring infections. They tell you her white count is like 87,000, right? That's already abnormal. And then let's say that this person has like, again, very low hemoglobin, has very low platelet counts, and she's been, again, having recurrent like pneumococcal infections, for example. What are you thinking about here? I really hope you're telling me about CLL. Right? CLL, right? So chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And what is the pathognomonic cell that you may find on a blood smear? It's a smudge cell, right? It's a smudge cell, right? So let me essentially give you guys a trick for getting these hematologic malignancies correct, right? I call this like the hematologic malignancy algorithm, right? So the first thing you want to remember is that the LLs lie at the extremes of age, right? So ALL is at the young extreme of age, CLL is at the old extreme of age, okay? And man, a kind of nice way to remember that is that A comes before C in the alphabet, right? So that's a nice way to think about that. And the LLs are at the extreme of age, right? So if you see like a young kid, right? This young kid has like a fairly high white count, right? Like it will be like a 5, 6, 7-year-old on NBMEs, fairly high white count. And again, every other thing is low. Platelets are low. Hemoglobin is low, right? Then you want to think about ALL, especially if it's a kid that has a history of Down syndrome. Remember, Down syndrome is very common in kids that ALL is very common in kids with Downs, right? So if you see those things, you want to think about ALL. Right? And ALL, because one thing that kind of messes with people's heads on exams is they think that ALL has to be a problem that has been brewing over months. No. Okay? ALL, from symptom onset to death, is actually a very short period. It's one of those diseases that if you don't nip it in the bud early, those kids can die pretty quickly. So on NBMEs, you may see these people, like, they've gone from normal, or they just tell you that over a couple of weeks they've been having symptoms. Don't be afraid to choose ALL. Again, especially if you see the classic presentation as I'm describing here. And then if you look at the other end of the spectrum, CLL, if you essentially see a person that is young on your exam, they can't have CLL. I'll just tell you that right now. CLL on NBMEs is an old person's disease. It's something that shows up in people that are like in their 70s or 80s. And the classic way it almost always presents is that they will have recurrent infections. And you may say, Defiance, kind of weird. How would they have a high white count, like white count of like 80, 70,000, but they're still not doing well, right? Well, the thing is, they have this B-cell malignancy. B-cells are proliferating a ton, right? But the thing is, those B-cells either don't make antibodies or the antibodies they make are not effective, okay? So CLL is almost like a functional immunodeficiency disease, okay? And remember, again, smudge cells on histology. That's like a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind because your friends at the NBMEs, right, they love to put pictures occasionally on these exams. And then if you're thinking like middle-aged, right? So if you're thinking about a middle-aged person, if they show you hour rods, right? So notice I've gone away from the extremes. Now I'm in middle-aged people, right? If they show you like hour rods, you know it's AML, right? There are many kinds of acute leukemia, but the only one that they usually test on exams, right, is acute promyelocytic leukemia. Remember that with the hour rods that can cause DIC, right? So if they describe a person with like AML and the person suddenly becomes unresponsive during surgery or whatever, right? You want to think about DIC from those hour rods spilling into the circulation, right? And remember that that has an association with the 15-17 translocation. And you obviously want to go ahead and give those people ATRA, right? So all trans-retinoic acid. Again, new trick that the NBME seems to be using quite often, especially with the newer exams, appears to be that they will take what you know and just give it a different description, right? So instead of saying all transretinoic acid, they may say like vitamin A derivative as an answer choice. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then if you see, again, middle-aged person, but they show you like BCR-ABL fusion protein, or they tell you something about the Philadelphia chromosome, or they give you like a CBC and you notice that it's kind of like weird cells that are proliferating, right? So they tell you that, oh, you're seeing like high numbers of like myelocytes and metamyelocytes and all that stuff. That's essentially code word on NBMEs for CML, okay? And remember CML, right? Obviously, again, like I said, BCR-ABL, fusion protein, right? Philadelphia chromosome. What's the chromosomal translocation? What is the chromosomal translocation that relates to CML? I hope you're telling me the 922 translocation, okay? So again, you want to keep that at the back of your mind, right? And then remember you treat it with imatinib. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Just as a general trick on exams, if a drug ends in nib, it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. End of story, okay? And then, so let's go on to our next scenario, right? So what if you get a question about, you know, like a 78-year-old guy, they tell you that you notice that on a peripheral smear, you see red blood cells that are stacked like coins. What am I describing? Well, I hope you're telling me the Rouleau formation, right? That's obviously multiple myeloma, as I already described. Okay, now what if you get a question about a 78-year-old guy, again, he has pancytopenia, so everything is low, and then they tell you that, When you try to aspirate the person's bone marrow, you observe a dry tap. So dry tap on aspiration of the bone marrow. Whenever you see that, I actually want you to think about three things on your exam. The first thing I want you to think about is primary myelofibrosis. Okay, that's one high yield thing you want to keep in mind. The second thing you want to keep in mind with that is essential thrombocythemia. Remember, essential thrombocythemia is one of those myeloproliferative disorders that has an association with like a JAK2 mutation. And then the third thing you want to think about is aplastic anemia. So again, dry tap on a bone marrow aspiration or a biopsy or whatever, that tells you that you're dealing with one of those three disorders. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 70-year-old female, over the last 6 months, she's been having like recurrent infections. They tell you that her white blood cell count is like 47,000. So you notice it's not crazy high like the others, like said for CLL, like 80, 70, even 100,000, right? And then they tell you that you see many cells in different stages of maturation, right? And then maybe they tell you on the exam that, oh, these cells are like myeloperoxidase positive, and they tell you that these cells have like reduced activity of leukocyte alkaline phosphatase. What am I going after here? I hope you're telling me CML. Okay, I hope you're telling me CML, right? Again, remember, 922 translocation, Philadelphia chromosome, you give imatinib, right? And remember, right, there's this weird thing that your friends at the MBME may love to throw on an exam, right? So, because if you have a white count of like 50,000, it could actually be from just a severe region infection, right, where you have like a leukomoid reaction to that. But remember that leukomoid reaction, you have like good, legit white blood cells. So a legit white blood cell marker like leukocyte alkaline phosphatase will be elevated in people that have a leukomoid reaction. But in CML, they tend to have low levels of leukocyte alkaline phosphatase because, again, those cells are abnormal. They don't function like normal B cells. So that's something, again, you kind of want to keep at the back. They don't function like normal myelocytes. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then, what if you get a question about, you know, like a 55-year-old guy, you know, he's like status post day 5 from like, you know, some kind of treatment of a hematologic malignancy. They tell you that his platelets are like 40,000, his D-dimers are markedly elevated, he's bleeding from every venipuncture site. What are you thinking about? What kind of hematologic malignancy are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking again about acute promyelocytic leukemia. Again, you'll find our rods on histology, right? Remember, those hours, again, like I said, they can trigger DIC, right? So they can easily make this a numbers game on the exam, right? So notice, instead of just telling you DIC, right, notice I'm giving you lab markers that tell you that you're dealing with DIC, right? So like, again, like low platelets, those people will have like high fibrin degradation products, right? Like they also have like high PTPTT, right? And again, you give all transretinoic acid. And again, remember, basically, the thing that's going on here is that whenever a person has DIC, all their platelet markers, all their coagulation markers just go out of whack, right? And then what if you get a question about, 5-year-old? Again, I'm just using this to reiterate because these are, again, all high-yield things to know for exams. So what if you get a question about, like, a 5-year-old female? Over the last 6 weeks, she has lost a ton of weight. She's having, like, daily fevers. You check a CBC, you notice that she's her hemoglobin and her platelets are low, but you notice that her white count is like 45,000, right? And then they tell you that, oh, they did some cytologic testing and they found cells that are positive for TDT. What are you thinking about? I hope you're telling me again, ALL. And again, remember the association of Down syndrome, right? Remember that thing where they say they all fall down, right? That's a nice mnemonic there. So fall down, Down syndrome, ALL. And then what if you get a question about like some guy in his 50s, he's again been having fever, weight loss, night sweats, and then they tell you that a peripheral smear reveals B cells with a bilobate nucleus. So B cells with a bilobate nucleus. What kind of cell am I describing here? Well, I hope you're telling me the Reed-Sternberg cells. Remember, those Reed-Sternberg cells, you tend to find them in Hodgkin's lymphoma, right? And you see, Devine, it's kind of weird. How can a person in their 50s get Hodgkin's lymphoma? Remember, your friends at the MBME, right? I don't know if you remember this from step one, where we talk about diseases that have like a bimodal distribution. Hodgkin's lymphoma is one of them. So it presents in young people, but there's also this big uptick around people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, okay? So it has a bimodal distribution. So you can already see how they can infuse this with a biostats question. Another way they can also kind of integrate that whole bimodal concept is people that metabolize isoniazid, right? There are people that are slow acetylators, and there are people that are fast acetylators, right? Those are always, they can test those concepts. And again, remember, Hodgkin's lymphoma, you're dealing with Reed-Sternberg cells, and those cells in general are CD15 and CD30 positive. Again, kind of high yield to know those things, right? And then if they give you a question about a person that has had, like, you know, they have like a known history of CML, okay? And then they tell you that over like a 3-week period, they're having like very high daily fevers, a ton of weight loss, they have like extensive diffuse lymphadenopathy. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about progression of the CML to AML. So these people have had something called a blast crisis. Okay, so that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. That's usually associated with like pretty bad mortality without like immediate treatment. Okay, now let's go over a few more high yield scenarios, right? So what if you get a question about like a 45-year-old female? She has like a 6-month history, intense pruritus, and then they tell you that you get a BMP and you notice that she has like a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, right? And then they tell you that, oh, on ultrasound, you notice that her intrahepatic bile ducts are dilated. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about PBC, right? So primary biliary cholangitis. It was previously known as a primary biliary cirrhosis, right? One thing you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind there is that PBC, right, is associated with anti-mitochondrial antibodies. And again, it will show up in a female that's like in her 40s or 50s or thereabouts. And she has like itching, pruritus, and a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, right? And really, the only definitive treatment is a liver transplant. But to temporize symptoms in the meantime, to help with like the itching and all that stuff and the jaundice, you can give them orsodiol, right? So instead of putting orsodiol, your friends at the MBME may put orsodeoxycholic acid. It's the same thing. And again, liver transplant, definitive treatment. And if they're asking you a question specifically about the itching, one thing you may want to consider on a test is to give diphenhydramine, okay? That's an unusual way they can present this PBC concept. Okay, now, what if you get a question about like a 45-year-old guy, he has a history of ulcerative colitis, and then they tell you that, again, he's had like a 6-month history of pruritus. And then they tell you that they get an ultrasound and you're seeing dilation of the intra and extrahepatic bile ducts. What are you thinking about? Again, I hope you're thinking about PSC, right? So primary sclerosing cholangitis, right? And remember that this is like P ANCA positive, right? The thing I tell people is, oh, Divine, it's so hard to memorize which is P ANCA, C ANCA, and all that crap. Here's basically what you should do. The only thing that you'll probably ever be responsible for, at least now, as far as I know, right now. Again, remember, Divine doesn't know everything. I'm just a student like all of you, right? So the only thing that I will say that in general, you should reasonably expect on the USMLE Step 2 CK exam with regards to CNCA is Wegener's, right? Every other thing you're going to learn about is PNCA positive. So that's kind of like a nice way to remember. So just remember this only thing that's CNCA positive, and then you know that every other thing that is ANCA positive has to be PNCA. And the high yield PNCA things you want to remember for step 2 CK, right? You want to remember things like Churg-Strauss syndrome, right? So like eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? Churg-Strauss, and then microscopic polyangiitis is also PNCA positive. And then you should also not forget that primary sclerosing cholangitis is also positive for PNCA, okay? Remember, PNCA deals with anti-myeloperoxidase antibodies, okay? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, if you're comparing PSC and PBC, you kind of want to be able to compare and contrast what I just said. In PSC, those people have dilation of their intra and extrahepatic bile ducts. In PBC, people have dilation of just their intrahepatic bile ducts, okay? And really, for the most part, for PSC, you're going to need a liver transplant. Orsodiol really doesn't help. It really doesn't improve survival in PSC, unlike what it does in PBC. And I mean, occasionally you can use like endoscopy to dilate the strictures, but ultimately those people are going to need a liver transplant. And then just as a throwback here, if you see a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, in a newborn on an MBME exam, what are the things you should be thinking about? I really hope you're saying back to me things like biliary atresia, right? That's like the big, big one. But if your friends at the MBME decide to not throw biliary atresia in as an answer choice, then you want to think about like a cholidocal cyst. Okay, a cholidocal cyst. If they want to be like really, really mean, they may put a like something called like Caroli's disease. Caroli's disease is a kind of cholidocal cyst. It's like a fairly common one with some unique features. So occasionally you may see that thrown in on an exam. Okay, now what if you get a question about a 25-year-old guy? They tell you that over the last couple of years, so again, note he's a young person. He's been having a lot of like sinusitis. He's been having hemoptysis. And then they tell you that he occasionally notices blood in his urine. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about Wegener's, right? Again, they may not necessarily call it Wegener's, or they may put the word Wegener's in parentheses. The new name, right, is granulomatosis with polyangiitis. So please, 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 here's the deal. Do not confuse granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which is Wegener's, with eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which is Churg-Strauss. Okay, those are two totally different diseases, right? So Wegener's, right, again, C anchor positive. Again, it could present as like a rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. And again, those people have kidney problems and sinus problems, right? And lung problems. If you see that, think about Wegener's, right? Think about Wegener's. You may say, oh, Divine, but that's kind of like the way that good pastures presents. Yes, I understand. Good pastures presents the same way. But people that have good pastures are not going to get sinusitis, okay? They're not going to get sinusitis. And another kind of like weird thing you want to keep in mind is that good pasture syndrome, for the most part, good pastures is a type of type, right? Good pasture syndrome is a type of, it's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? Because you're making antibodies against the fixed antigen. Contrast that with Wegener's, right? Where you're making antibodies against, it's like an antigen-antibody complex that's causing all this trouble, right? So in Wegener's, that's more of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. Yeah, the hypersensitivities are things the MBME seems to be, again, be a little more focused on these days. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, Wegener's, right, you can treat it with like steroids and cyclophosphamide. Now, what if you get a question about, again, 25-year-old guy, you know, new onset asthma, you get a urinalysis, you are seeing like dysmorphic erythrocytes. Again, instead of saying red blood cell casts, your friends at the MBME may want to interpret that as dysmorphic erythrocytes. So that's something you want to keep in mind. So what does this person have, right? This person obviously has Churg-Strauss, right? Remember Churg-Strauss, they'll have like asthma, right? You'll see a ton of eosinophilia, right? So if you see one of these like ANCA vasculitides, and you see like asthma as a component, a ton of eosinophils as a component, the first thing I want you to think about is Churg-Strauss. And again, remember Churg-Strauss is also known as EGPA, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. And again, remember, it's, again, P anchor positive, kind of like microscopic polyangiitis. And those are, again, the big things you want to keep in mind. And really, these rapidly progressive glomerulonephritides, they present as nephritic syndromes on MBMEs. They present as nephritic syndromes. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about, like, a 35-year-old female? They tell you that she comes in, she says, yeah, doc, I've been having, like, you know, like, intermittent discoloration of my fingers. And then they tell you that physical exam is notable for like diffuse skin thickening. What are you thinking about here, right? I hope you're thinking again about scleroderma, right? Remember, scleroderma, there's like the limited kind, right? So like the LCSS, limited cutaneous systemic sclerosis. And then there's the diffuse one, right? The limited one, you want to know your antibodies. Remember like your CREST antibodies, right? I mean your anti-centromere antibodies, because it's known as like CREST scleroderma, right? And what does the CREST stand for, right? It's like calcinosis, right? Raynaud's phenomenon is the R. The E, if I'm not mistaken, is esophageal dysmotility, right? The S stands for like sclerodactyly, right? So like the finger problems they have. And then the T stands for telangiectasias, okay? So remember anti-centromere antibodies versus the one that's more diffuse, right? Where you're thinking about like anti-SCL70 antibodies, right? Like your anti-topoisomerase antibodies. And remember that if a person has scleroderma renal crisis, right? So they describe a person very high creatinines, very elevated blood pressures, history of scleroderma. For those people, you obviously want to strongly consider giving them, you want to strongly consider giving them an ACE inhibitor. ACE inhibitors are the drugs of choice in the treatment of a scleroderma renal crisis. And remember that scleroderma, right, there are certain drugs you'd want to avoid in those people, right? You want to avoid drugs that are vasospastic. So if, for example, a person that has a history of scleroderma, they give you a question about them beginning to have migraines, right? For those people, right, again, this would be a wonderful new style kind of NBME question. It doesn't make sense to give those people sumatriptan, right? Remember, sumatriptan is one of those drugs that are contraindicated in people that have a history of like vasospastic disease, right? So if, for example, a person has a history of like Raynaud's phenomenon in the context of a scleroderma, you don't want to do that, right? Another set of people that you don't want to give sumatriptan to are people that have a history of like a Prinz medal angina. I think these days it's called variant angina. You want to avoid vasospastic drugs like sumatriptan, okay? Because remember, sumatriptan is a serotonin receptor agonist, right? So it can trigger vasospasm, right? So it's not good. Remember, in general, just as a Cliff's Notes, again, this is super oversimplified, but in general, the presence of vasodilation is associated with headache. So when you give a vasoconstrictor, headache tends to abate. I mean, think about it. Ibuprofen, your NSAIDs, what do your NSAIDs do? They inhibit cyclooxygenase. If you inhibit cyclooxygenase, you have low levels of prostaglandins. So you're having low levels of a vasodilator, and again, that seems to help with headaches. Again, there's a lot more pathophys, but this is a rapid review, so I'm not going to go any further than that. Now, my last scenario, right? So let me pose this as a multiple choice question. So let's assume you get a question about like a 35-year-old female. She comes to a PCP in April. You know, she's coming for an annual physical. She's in good health. She's enjoying her daily job. Her blood pressure is just fine. 120 over 80. Heart rate 79. Respiratory rate 14. And then they tell you that all the vital signs, her CBC labs, everything, they're all within normal limits, right? She doesn't have JVD, doesn't have peripheral edema. I'm just trying to make this an NBME style question, right? Because again, they'll give you all these details and all this fun stuff, right? And then they tell you her peripheral pulses, 2+ bilaterally. She doesn't have any evidence of respiratory distress. She had a flu shot last year. And again, notice she's coming in April for her annual physical. And then they tell you that, you know, she's up to date on all her vaccinations. And they tell you that when you listen to her chest, you hear, you know, like a benign 2/6 diastolic murmur with an opening snap at the apex. Okay. And then they tell you that her breath sounds are equal bilaterally. She has good airflow, no wheezing, no crackles, no ronchi. And then they ask, what's the next best step in management? And then they offer you a few options, right? The first one, they tell you influenza vaccination. Option B, they tell you reassure the patient, like reassurance. Option C, they tell you transthoracic echocardiography. Option D, they tell you to do like a VQ scan, so like a ventilation perfusion scan to rule out PE. And then option E, they tell you to start her on clothalidone therapy, right? So what kind of answer would you want to go with here? So again, first thing, figure out what am I trying to test with this question? Again, I hope you're telling me that this person has a murmur, right? Because again, everything is normal in the question, but you see, notice that this person has a 2/6 diastolic murmur, right? Remember, if a person has a murmur that is systolic, that's 3/6 or greater, you need to get an echo, right? And if a person has any kind of diastolic murmur, you need to work it up. Or if a person has any murmur that is symptomatic, you need to work it up as well. So that's what I'm going after here. And then you, for those that were considering the other answers, this lady is coming in April. When do people get the influenza vaccine? Usually kind of like in the fall, right? So that's kind of like wrong timing there. And then you're not going to reassure this woman. She has like an actual problem, right? I mean, if you even think about it, she has like a diastolic murmur, heard best at the apex, opening snap. That's likely like mitral stenosis, right? That's likely like mitral stenosis. And then you don't want to do a VQ scan because she doesn't have any evidence of a pulmonary embolus, and clothalidone will not be appropriate. Remember, clothalidone is an example of a thiazide diuretic, right? It's not appropriate in this patient because she's not hypertensive. Her blood pressure is 120 over 80. So this person, again, mitral stenosis, right? Again, if you have any kind of diastolic murmur, any systolic murmur that is 3/6 or greater. So if you have a systolic murmur that is 2/6, 1/6, you don't need to get an echo for those, okay? You absolutely do not need to get an echo for those. The only exception to that rule is if a person has a murmur that is symptomatic. So if a person has like a 1/6 systolic ejection murmur and they are passing out, they have like syncope or whatever with that, then obviously you want to go ahead and work that up and you want to get an echocardiogram. And just some weird, I guess, quick things I want to sort of mention here is These are like classic things your friends at the MBME love to throw on exams. But if a person, if you're trying to choose like doing a stress test in someone, and they tell you in the question that the person has like some EKG problem, like a left bundle branch block, inferior Q waves, whatever weirdness they put, then you cannot do any kind of stress test that involves EKGs, right? So that's again a high yield thing you want to keep in mind. If a person has a pre-existing EKG abnormality, then you really should not be doing any kind of stress test that involves EKGs. You can do like a stress echo, you can do an exercise echo and all that stuff. If a person cannot exercise or they have like severe osteoarthritis and all that stuff, then you cannot do a stress test that involves exercise, right? You want to proceed with the pharmacological stress test. And those pharmacological stress tests, right, you can give something that can speed up the heart, right? So you can give like a beta 1 agonist, like a dobutamine, right? You can give something like dobutamine that can help. Another thing you can do is you can take advantage of the coronary steel principle. If I'm not mistaken, I believe I described that thoroughly in my shelf medicine video. So the coronary steel principle, you can sort of take advantage of that. So you can use like an adenosine analog like regadenosine, apadenosine, or you can use like a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, right? Like dipyridamole, okay? And you may say, oh, Divine, what if the MBME gives me a question where I see regadenosine as an answer choice and I see dobutamine as an answer choice? The thing you need to remember is that every MBME question is written with one. You can never have two correct answers to an MBME question. Even if you may see certain questions, you're like, man, both of these things are pretty close, right? The thing is, you need to go back to the question. There has to be information there that will lead you towards one answer versus the other, right? So for example, if you're trying to choose between those two things and the person has like a history of asthma, right? Or like reactive airway disease, then it doesn't make sense to give an adenosine analog or dipyridamole, right? Because the thing is, those people, if you give them adenosine, they will have like bronchospasm, and that'll be bad, right? That'll be really bad. Remember that adenosine can cause a bronchoconstriction, okay? So that will, right there, that will tell you that, okay, it's probably not a smart idea to give those people those drugs. And remember, I mean, the MBME, again, they can even write questions where, again, you're deciding between like a beta blocker and some other drug, right? If a person has a history of asthma, a non-selective beta blocker is not a smart idea, right? It's not a smart idea. So those are things you want to keep in mind. If the person has drunk caffeine that morning, then doing an adenosine-based cardiac chemical stress test, like a pharmacologic stress test, again, also makes no sense. Because remember that caffeine or like theophylline, right, your methylxanthines, they antagonize the effects of adenosine. So again, I apologize. This has probably gone on a little long, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Remember, as I say at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, right? So step 1, step 2 CK, step 2 CS, step 3, the preclinical med school exams, the third year shelf exams. And then if you're a medicine resident, I do tutor, believe it or not, for the medicine in training exam and also the internal medicine boards, like the ABIM board exams. I tutor for all those things. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring for physics, gen chem, ochem, biochemistry, physiology, histology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, I know this is kind of application season, so like ERAS applications with like personal statements, your entire ERAS application, recommendation letters, mock interviews, and all those things, I do a lot of consulting and advising with that. I do it on a one-on-one basis. And also if you're a med student, if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP, again, I've been on an admissions committee at a top 2 med school. I've read tons of high quality applications. So I have a lot of experience with this. I worked with a ton of people this last cycle, and essentially everyone I worked with matched. Most people matched to their first choice. So take that for what you will. So if you need any of those things, reach out to me through the website or send me an email. So I wish you a very wonderful rest of your night. I hope you all have a good sleep, and feel free to reach out to me and have a wonderful Sunday. God bless you. Thank you.